to do that, you can't just be a space designer, because these ideas are not just space ideas. They're ideas that combine space and digital and people in almost every instance, because that is what an experience is. It's the combination of those three things. And so it's not surprising that maybe they haven't been able to truly ideate on the business solution that they need. Yeah, it might be a bigger conference room, more desks, or more density, but that isn't what is going to bring people back to the office. What's going to bring people back to the office and make them want to come back is bespoke designs of space around key moments in collaboration. And that just takes more than a space design.
My guest today is Keith Jacobs, the co-CEO and founder of Geniant. In Chicago, you might know Geniant as the firm that purchased Eastlake Studios, a well-regarded design and architectural company. But Geniant does a lot more than just interior design and architecture. They combine architecture, interior design with people consulting, change management, and even software development. In this discussion with Keith, I think you'll find it interesting how he brings all these together to create the optimal solution for his clients. He's founded a number of similar design type related firms over the years, and is also a guest lecturer at his alma mater, University of Texas. I hope you enjoy the program.
Keith, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Dougal. Thanks for having me. I'm excited about today's conversation.
Good. So let's start. Can you describe the unique approach to understanding how people work in the physical space? You've got a three-pronged approach, so maybe you can talk about that.
Yeah, absolutely. We founded Geniant in the height of the pandemic in the fall of 2021. And we have a pedigree of creating companies that design experiences. We've done that for over 20 years. And we wanted to focus on helping companies deal with shifting realities. So wherever experience design can help a business overcome a reality that's shifting underneath them, that's why we built Geniant. And the number one shifting reality we wanted to tackle is what we call employee experience for hybrid work, which is essentially the idea that before the pandemic, everyone was working 5 days a week in offices. They didn't really have a choice whether they came to the office or not. And post-pandemic, obviously that changed. People went home and then they didn't want to come back, and companies struggled with how to shape the employee experience that would not only allow employees to return to the office and be productive, but make them want to come back. And that's been a struggle for companies for a long time. But we have this history in employee experience, and we know that experiences are made up of three things. They're made up of the way that we experience physical space. They're made up of people-to-people interactions, so processes and interactions with other humans. And more and more commonly in the workplace, they're made up of digital moments, times that we're interacting with technology. And so our hypothesis was that it is not possible to just focus on any one of those crafts. If you are trying to help a company solve an employee experience for hybrid work, a return to office scenario, and you're only focusing on the office, that's not going to work. If you're only focusing on the org chart and culture and people, that's not going to work. And if you're only using technology to solve the problem and people aren't getting back together and aren't collaborating, that's not going to work either. So when we founded Geniant, we created three practices, and we went out and hired people from around the country, the best in that we think in the world as craftspeople in digital, people, and space. And particularly in space, we acquired a company here in Chicago that was formerly called Eastlake Studios, an over 30-year history of designing workplace. And we spent the first 6 months learning from their craftspeople about space and combining them with our craftspeople who understood digital and people. And the pinnacle of combining these three crafts is ethnographic research. It's something we're going to talk about hopefully more in our discussion today. And so we assembled Geniant, and we focused first on this first major shifting reality, and we've helped dozens of clients now with this employee experience for hybrid work offering.
Yeah, and it is really unique. I mean, I'm trying to think, what do you call yourself?
We call ourselves a consulting firm.
Okay.
But it is, even that we don't love. We're not an agency. We're not a design firm only. Although we care deeply about employee, about human experience and design, mm-hmm. 2/3 of our employees and the projects that we do have digital components to them, and about 1/3 have space, and almost all of them have people components. Mm-hmm. So yeah, this is something relatively new, but it is a professional services firm. So we are tackling problems on behalf of all of our clients in all three of these practices.
In a very holistic approach.
That is the idea. Yeah, for sure. And I love to use that word, but it is a little bit businessy or salesy, holistic. And, yeah. and so I'll give you a little bit of background on the reality of what it takes to do holistic design. It takes creating a culture and a process and a methodology where craftspeople who have never worked together before are coming together for the first time and learning about what each other values. And clients will not pay for that. The customer in the end wants a problem to be solved and counts on us to keep them from having to be a general contractor. Imagine if you're a major employer and you've hired one of the traditional design firms to work on your office, and those firms don't understand deeply the science of people or the science of technology, then that client has to go hire another consulting firm that knows one of those other crafts, and the client has to bring them together. And they haven't invested in this methodology, the sharing, this intellectual exercise of understanding each other's crafts. So part of the secret sauce of building a really great services firm is for you to make that investment up front, for you to bring those people together. And it's cultural, it's methodology or intellectual, it's financial, making sure that the money works and that you're giving great returns to clients so that when they invest a dollar, they get $10 back. And so that is what all gets baked into this holistic word. So a lot of people talk about it, but this is what we've done in our careers and we're doing again at Geniant.
Right. And your background is in software.
It is, yeah.
So when did you come up with, or what did you see, what inspired you to put all these pieces together?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great question. I wrote my last line of code in 1998. So it's been a while since I've been a technologist, although our pedigree and where we truly learned the science of experience design is in the digital world. That's where we had past companies and had past successes. And those were consulting companies as well. So we were always delivering solutions for other clients. Early on in that journey of software development became digital experience design. We learned about a science that's anthropological in nature. It's based on anthropology. And it's called ethnographic research. And the idea behind ethnographic research is that if you want to design really great experiences, you cannot ask the person for whom you're designing what they want. Surveys, workplace strategy spreadsheets, to use a physical space example, these things are all substandard in creating really amazing experiences for humans. Because people can't tell you what they want. First of all, they'll tell you what pissed them off 15 minutes ago, which is valuable, don't get me wrong. You do want to hear that feedback. Or they're not able to tell you because they don't know what's possible in the science of your craft, whether it be space or digital or people. And so instead, what we in the digital world have done for decades now is we observe humans doing the task that is not working today. We observe them in context. And the we is not me. I'm on your podcast. I talk too much to be a great researcher. These are people who have deep levels of empathy and understanding, anthropology majors.
They're the people who sit in a bar and in the corner and observe, right?
When they do go to a bar, they observe. And their observations, if these people are your friends, are always so deep. And you're like, wow, that's amazing. Right. Cognitive psychologists, we hire psychologists and anthropologists. These are full-time employees of Geniant. And it's not that we don't want our workplace designers to also walk the floor and that we also don't want surveys. Those things are fine. But these deep insights, we run them like science experiments. So we write a hypothesis with the client. For example, a hypothesis might be why people want to return to work or why they don't want to return to work. And then we study the business process that the humans are doing in that physical space. And we write a protocol, literally like what our employees were taught in college when they learned the science of creating an experiment. And then we execute the protocol, which is mainly observing and occasionally asking pointed questions about what the person is doing in that experience. This can be anyone from a salesperson who's closing a multi-million dollar deal to an accounts payable clerk or an HR person. Everyone has an important role to play in these clients, and they make up what we call personas. So we observe all of these personas and we take notes. Whether we prove or disprove the hypothesis almost doesn't matter. Just like any great science, what matters is the data you collect as you're attempting to prove or disprove the hypothesis. And we collect a lot of data, sometimes 1,000 data points or more, to take all those data points, drop them into buckets. You find patterns. So 1,000 data points gets dropped into 50 categories, and each of those categories is a new feature over the past 20 years that was digital. But over the past 3 years, we've taken this approach and applied it to space. And we've unlocked new ways to design space that are different than what people were doing before the pandemic, because we didn't ask people what they wanted, we observed them.
And I think, you know, what struck me is this digital component. If you take the example of the salesperson who's going to close a multi-million dollar deal, you'll observe their entire process.
As much as we can.
As much as you can, which will include how they're communicating with the client, how they're communicating with their own people digitally as well as physically, and all those sort of things.
That is exactly right. And we didn't prepare for this, but you actually have picked a really great example of a project. It's a program, a series of projects that we're delivering for a client right now in that exact instance. Because there are dozens of examples, more than we probably have time for in the podcast, of basic employee experience challenges of people returning to work and not returning to work and solving those problems. The salesperson one is really interesting. It is also an employee experience challenge. One of our clients is a $2 billion revenue, 7,000 person financial services company. And we are doing a campus redesign for them in chunks of a program. And one of the biggest projects that we are working on recently is a redesign of their, what we would call executive briefing center. Essentially an innovation center, a place for their clients to fly in from all over the world to observe how this software they're going to purchase for their financial services business works. And the previous designer thought of this space, looked to their left and their right, saw what other financial services companies were doing in executive briefing centers and kind of copied that. And not that that didn't work great, but our client wanted to redesign the space with a specific business result in mind. They wanted to invest a dollar in this briefing center and get $10 back. And that is the holy grail of all consulting projects, but especially in space, it's sometimes hard to prove ROI in these projects. With this research methodology that we use, it becomes a lot easier, because what are we doing in the research methodology? We're mapping out the entire journey, the employee journey or the customer journey, as we're doing this research. And we can find breakpoints in that journey. And guess what? In the case of a sales process, a breakpoint means a lower conversion rate. So if we fix that breakpoint that we identified, that maybe no one could have even told us, but we observed it happening. If we fix that breakpoint and it costs a dollar to fix the breakpoint, we can then measure over the next year or 2 years or 5 years the return on invested capital of having fixed
the problem. So give me a better idea. What might be a breakpoint? Not necessarily for this, but give me an example.
No, yeah. Actually, for this client, for an example, would be the transition of a person from the city they originated from flying on a corporate jet that was owned by our client to fly them to the executive briefing center, and then checking into a hotel and then arriving at the briefing center and going through a day of briefings. The hotel was the weak link. They would fly into this city. They had a decent experience in the executive briefing center. We're making it a lot better. But the company could not control the hotel, and there are not a lot of hotels where they are. Mm-hmm. So we are now going to be designing a hotel as part of that solution.
That's really interesting.
And there'll be a capital expense in that.
Yeah.
But
is the company going to be investing in this hotel?
Partially, in partnership. Wow. Yeah, okay. That's exactly right. And we see a weak link in that experience. And this is a very large company. We're all not going to be designing hotels. This could happen on a single conference room level. The same concept. Our research could identify something that somebody didn't tell us about a key meeting, let's say a weekly meeting for a department, where it's just so important that people be there in person. And so because we combine people, digital, and space, our space team can get insights from research that would allow us to change the digital technologies they're using, maybe even change the rhythm of meetings, to time it so that all the people in that very key meeting are arriving at the same time and being in the office at the same time. So many times our clients are using mandates. Return to work 3 days a week. And we'll, you know, if they're very nice, each department can choose which day they return to work. And then when we're in doing our research where these processes, these mandates have failed, we see half the team is in the office, but they all have their laptops open and they're on Zoom from the office, Zooming with three other people that are at home. And it's not like anyone meant for that to happen. It just wasn't thoughtful enough of a return to work approach. And it couldn't possibly have been without research. So that's an example of work that we've done. And it ties back to this return on investment theme that we hear from clients a lot.
Yeah. And that's a great example. I mean, a very concrete example of a certain magnitude that, like you said, not everyone can replicate. But if you scale it down to all the different things that go into that process, that could be very helpful to a lot of people. And you touched upon one thing in that I kind of want to dig into a little bit more. And this seems time-consuming, labor-intensive, and also, like you said, I mean, they're observing. They're not asking the question and expecting a response.
Yeah.
I mean, in this environment where it's 3 days in and, you know, 2 days out, let's say, do they have to set up a protocol to observe different vignettes?
They do, yeah.
Okay.
Let me address the labor thing first, because that is a question we get all the time.
And when I say labor intensive, from, I think, the client side, right?
Yes,
like exactly. How much time and investment do I have to put into this?
That's right. Our time and investment in upfront research is not that much more expensive than programming. A typical programming exercise, it's just much richer and much more valuable and generates more ROI data. That part, it doesn't cost them more to engage with us. But what they are concerned about, as you said, is what about our time? So,
and also, quite frankly, how disruptive.
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely. We do a lot of this work in healthcare and financial services, and we're in pretty much every industry. And there are certainly some industries where we have an ideal protocol that we've written that can absolutely not be done. You know, we can't go, you know, watch a healthcare, a doctor performing a surgery, for example, you know, where we've done design of digital experiences for health systems. We can't look at certain data because it's protected by HIPAA or protected by, you know, PHI. And of course, there are clients who say, look, I'll let you observe some things, but I'm about to close a $100 million software deal. You're not just going to be sitting in the back of the room with a notepad. We have a lot of different techniques where we can observe through recordings. We can observe in person. It's not incredibly disruptive in that the number of observations we need is far less than the number of people you would send a survey to. Because if, let's say, you're sending a survey out to 1,000 people, it's likely that those 1,000 people fit into roughly 10 to 20 personas. And we only need to observe one of those personas for each, or a few at most, for each one of them. So we don't have to talk to all 7,000 people at that financial services company. In fact, a combination of some workshops that we ran that had roughly 50 people each in them, plus very few observations, netted a bunch of new space design ideas that wouldn't have come out otherwise.
Are these personas... So these are pretty standardized personas you find across all industries, across all companies, across society, essentially?
We begin with that.
Okay.
But the news that we have to share with a lot of people in physical space, which we have known in digital for a long time, is that with return to work in particular, copying and pasting what other companies are doing in the same industry is not working. So a lot of designers, I think, would hearken back on a 10 other law firm designs they did when they're working on the 11th law firm and say, well, this worked 10 other times. This research process does require us to get a little bit more knowledgeable about the differences in how each of the law firms operate, for example, or each of the financial services firms operate. And that means we would adjust their personas somewhat. But in general, yes, the personas would generally follow, they would start with the org chart of the company, and then in many cases, say, for example, a junior business development person, there might be two personas because there's people who do that job in two different ways. The ultimate goal of the persona and the research experiment is to capture the mental mode the person's in before we start designing the space or the digital experience or the people interaction. So not every person in one role or one level of an org chart operates the same way. And we do want to understand those differences. So yeah, it's a little bit of a balancing act,
right.
but we have this concept of the point of least astonishment in research, which means we don't have to conduct the entire science experiment 100 times over, to exaggerate. Mm-hmm. If in the third time we're seeing the same patterns, we can just stop. And we will have collected enough data to be able to inform the design much better.
Right.
than a typical programming exercise where an architect or interior designer might just walk the floor and ask some questions and do a survey and then ask the executives what they want and then look at their last project and go. That's what's not producing the results we need post-pandemic, where we can't just force people back to the office.
One of the challenges I've seen, and this is really more on the workplace strategy side, is solutions will be provided to the leadership team. Not solutions, observations will be provided to the leadership team, and not necessarily an ROI, what you're talking about, but solutions in terms of how people can potentially be more productive in a space, which is always the big thing.
Yes.
Health, wellness, productivity. And then ultimately the C-suite will decide what to do and maybe not even employ any of that. I'm curious from your side of the business and your area, how much of what you recommend gets implemented versus thanks for the information, this is valuable, we're going to go down this path of whatever it is.
Right, yeah. It's such a good question. And as craftspeople, when we have what we perceive are great ideas, we want them all to be right. invested in, of course, and we get very passionate about it. But I have two observations for you, you know, that I thought of when you were asking that question. The first is that the traditional workplace strategy programming process doesn't do a great job of tying the investment that we're asking our customers to make directly to ROI. And so it is sometimes hard for those executives who are essentially either they own the company and they're, you know, running and operating the company, or if we're working at a level below that, they're risking their careers by deciding whether or not to follow these recommendations.
If it's transformative enough, absolutely.
Absolutely, yeah. And if, by the way, if it's not transformative enough, that could be even worse long term. I mean, right. Pre-pandemic, CEOs weren't judged on how many days a week people came into the office.
Absolutely.
Now, the office can fail a C-suite by not being transformative enough. So yeah. We have a little bit of an easy button in that our process always ties the designs we're doing back to ROI better than that typical approach. So what we see is the opposite. We see clients asking us to come in after they've received a workplace strategy document that was underwhelming and asked us not to throw it all away, but to help them through ethnographic research and observation to refine those ideas and tie them to ROI. So that's one thought I have. The second thought is that, and I'm relatively new to this world of space, but not new to experience design, I've been surprised at how little early ideation happens when workplace strategy or our research identifies a really great solution to a problem. And then traditionally, I've seen our competitors will just kind of hand that workplace strategy document over and say, this is what you should go do. And there's a gap between the beginning of getting to do that thing and the recommendation. And the burden is on the customer, the client, to figure out what did they mean by that. And so if we take it just a little bit further and imagine what the more than one, the sometimes multiple solutions that to the identified problem could be, we make it easier on our customers. But to do that, you can't just be a space designer, because these ideas are not just space ideas. They're ideas that combine space and digital and people in almost every instance, because that is what an experience is. It's the combination of those three things. And so it's not surprising that maybe they haven't been able to truly ideate on the business solution that they need. Yeah, it might be a bigger conference room or more desks or more density, but that isn't what is going to bring people back to the office. What's going to bring people back to the office and make them want to come back is bespoke designs of space around key moments in collaboration. And that just takes more than a space designer.
Right. How do you feel about remote work? 100% remote work. Now, the reality is very, very, very few companies are doing 100% remote work. So it's almost a foregone conclusion, right? Everyone's doing some level of in-person. But is there any area or industry where that's an effective model? I mean, besides just the cost savings of occupancy costs.
Yeah. This is it's another great question, because I come from the world of software and we were utilizing remote work in significant levels long before the pandemic ever happened. In fact, I think for many software companies and companies who focused on doing digital or technology work, there wasn't much of a disruption during the pandemic, especially for the smaller companies that were already operating in a hybrid mode. So having operated those teams for, you know, decades, I cannot imagine a team being successful without spending some time in person. I might sound like a broken record, but the wrong answer is just to take the rhythm of meetings you've had for 10 years and just move them to Zoom and force people back a few days a week and see what happens. The right answer on how to get the maximum out of collaboration, and I'm not talking about changing the entire rhythm of a business, but it's to look at those key points in the journey of those employees, where they come together and where that value really is, and nurture those. We've seen clients who have decided instead of coming back to work 3 days a week, we'll come back to work 1 month a quarter, or 2 weeks every four months. And because in the rhythm of the way they run their business, the collaborations that are most important for people happen during that time. Without research, we can guess at what those might be, and we'd love for all of our clients to be self-aware, but sometimes you need an outside person who's experienced in observation to try to figure that out.
Right.
We have not yet had a client where we did research and it ended up resulting in, actually, you shouldn't have an office. We haven't seen a single example of that.
Yeah. One of the top complaints with people coming back to the office is the commute. So you're going to observe all the breakdowns in the process. How do you fix that?
Yeah, that's a difficult one. Many, many of our observations, not just in workplace, but in many of the shifting realities we focus on, start in people's homes. We've spent a lot of time observing people, what they do at home as it relates to work or interaction with a
product. Like you'll literally go to
their homes.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. That's a new one.
Yeah.
That's kind of cool.
Yeah, it is. And it sounds weird. And obviously we are invited in and it's those individuals have to want.
I assume that.
Yeah. But I'll tell you, it's human nature to want for someone to care about your experience. Most people, we might not want folks, you know, up in our kitchen, but most people, when asked what is, you know, going right and going wrong about your experience, or even better, let me observe and let me share some of the observations I'm seeing with you, people get excited about that. And that research results in building evangelists. So when we are doing something more transformational, now the CEO has 50 or 100 of his employees who are saying, we love this process. We went through this process with this researcher from Genient and she identified all sorts of really interesting things. And I can totally see how this new design is going to work. And we create evangelists by involving people in the observations.
Yeah.
Okay. Sorry, that was a sidebar. One way we've been talking about this challenge of commute is by talking about ways that we can make the office a more attractive place for hybrid workers when they do come in. And if you think of it as a fraction, you have a numerator and a denominator, top of the fraction and bottom. The top of the fraction that I think everyone is focused on is amenities. And we hear that all the time and people care about it all the time. They want to maximize amenities for a worker. And that is good. I mean, by the way, that's wonderful and we should keep focusing on that. The denominator of the fraction is the distance from their office, not in miles, but in time. And so one area that people have that we've been working on with clients is the idea of a hub and spoke model, where instead of one very large corporate campus, they might have many smaller campuses. If you just ask people to come back to work 3 days a week, and then they just pick one of the campuses, one of the smaller campuses, and you don't bespoke schedule these collaboration interactions at key locations, then that isn't going to work any better. You might get people back to the office more and you might be able to check that box on the occupancy sensor, but you might not really achieve a shift in the performance of your business unless you think about how you plan that collaboration. The other thought about the numerator of that fraction, the amenities. Amenities in a city like Chicago especially, the amenity war is on for sure and it's not stopping. And amenities do make us happy when we're in the office. But most information workers, people who are doing information work, are also happy when they enter what's called a flow state. And I think most of us have heard of this concept of flow state. This is when you are performing at the 99th percentile of your ability and you're succeeding for multiple hours. So you're just in the flow and you're knocking things out, you're being productive, or you're collaborating with employees. When designed correctly, that human experience is almost addictive. It is incredibly rewarding. It makes you feel great. Now,
well, certainly from a developer standpoint, that's where the term was coined, right?
That's exactly right. And it came from the world of development, but we've seen it in every persona we've ever worked with. Accounts payable people, human resources people, salespeople. We all know that.
Less distractions?
Sometimes.
Okay.
But could be more collaboration.
Okay.
Depends on the role and depends on the persona. And it's not the pre-pandemic way of just, well, let's build more conference rooms. Right. You have to really understand the work that those people are doing.
Yeah.
And none of us can maintain that flow state more than 2 or 3 hours. Yeah. The Olympic equivalent of that would be like a PhD professor who writes, publishes a paper a month. She might be able to maintain that state for 6 hours and she'll be exhausted afterwards. Yeah. So we don't need that for 12 hours a day. Mm-hmm. But if we create that and truly protect that experience, mm-hmm. it's worth leaving home for one day a week mm-hmm. or for some short number of days a week as part of the overall experience to achieve that flow state.
Right.
And so our company's designed this template from which we began, where we have maximized the ability for a human to get into that flow state by designing more zones in a typical office. So instead of the kind of 3 or 4 typical zones, we'll sometimes design as many as 6 or 7 different zones that match the truly what the research is showing, 6 or 7 different mental states that that person is going through in a day. And if we create as little cognitive dissonance as possible and create as great of a design as possible, then our chance of putting each of our team members into that flow state increases, higher productivity for the business, happier employees that not that popcorn and green spaces aren't nice, but I've got popcorn and trees at home. Mm-hmm. But my ability to reach that flow state at home, especially where for a certain persona, the flow state is happening in a collaborative session. That just can't happen over Zoom.
Right. And so those states are, or those areas are explore, socialize, library, office, highly focused and contemplative. Is that
contemplative? Yeah, or contemplative. That's right. Oh, you've done your homework. Yes, that's exactly right. And I don't want to do too many plugs for Geniet.com, but there is a video that describes this. But yes, the idea, the concept behind it is that as humans, each mental mode that we're in as we shift from highly social to highly focused should be one gradient deeper in each direction. So I walk into the office and I want to see people and enter into a collaborative space, but to get myself into the flow state, I need to move slowly from highly social to highly focused.
What do you mean, move slowly?
In the modern office, we see many designs where we're doing a redesign. I'm in a break room or I'm in a social space, and then I sit down at my desk in an open plan and that might be the most focused I could possibly get. And I don't have a private office, and we don't want to give everyone private offices. That doesn't make sense. But we could design part of the office for someone to make a transition from an entry place to a library-style area and a social space, and then shallow work in an open plan, deep work in, say, a private office.
Yeah.
And what we've seen in our research is that when people exit the flow state, it is jarring. It's hard when you're no longer in that flow state. And they need a space, which we call contemplative, for them to decharge. It could be maybe 15 minutes. And then they work their way back. Instead of going right back into the break room and having this jarring transition, they go back to shallow work and then back to lightly social and then back to highly social.
That's a great point. And that reminds me of, I mentioned I had Howard Tolman on.
Oh, right. Yes.
Who wrote an Inc. column, essentially, what was it called? It was Zoom. Yeah. For lack of a better title, it was Zoom is not good for meetings.
Right. Exactly.
And he talked about how it's the meeting after that meeting that's so important. And the minute that Zoom is done, boom, shuts down and you're virtual and you're done. But so much happens when you walk out of the conference room and you're going back and you talk to your, let's say your boss and, you know, hey, tell me more about that idea. And you just can't recreate that. Oh, you can't recreate meetings in the Zoom, I guess.
Yeah, that transient or liminal moment that you're describing where a little bit of extra magic happens, that all in our research has shown that also happens in the flow state. And so exiting the flow state, if you exit it right into a Zoom meeting or right into a highly social area and you're not moving out of it, this is all in a templated model. This gets customized for every one of our clients, of course. Yeah. But if you don't take advantage of that, you might not maximize the human experience that coworker could have in the office.
So looking forward to the future, trends that you've seen emerge over the last few years, either as a result of COVID or just the general socialization of people or lack of socialization of people. Yeah. What sort of trends do you see moving forward that are going to continue, or what new trends might show up?
Yeah, well, I've gotten a chance to talk a lot about this concept of bespoke designs and being more intentional about how we design spaces post-pandemic. I think that is the number one trend. We've made a big bet on research helping achieve that, but it's just hard to unsee once you see that we cannot just build every law firm relatively the same with some spreadsheet that says we need this density and this number of conference rooms, and we need a more focused solution to be able to do that. So that's definitely a trend that we see. And as a digital guy, I'd be remiss not to mention AI. I mentioned at the top of the podcast about how Genius focused on shaping experiences for shifting realities, the idea that we're helping clients shape human experiences around a reality that's shifting underneath them. AI is the next shifting reality. And so that is the next big shift that we're focused on. And obviously on the digital side, there are some extremely large impacts of artificial intelligence to human productivity in the modern workplace. I'll just say for the space perspective, we've been a little underwhelmed by the tool sets that have been released so far to help designers of space truly use artificial intelligence to make their designs better or to make them more productive. And we're super early. This is super early days. So I know it could be as little as a month and as much as 6 months to a year, we're going to see amazing improvements in this. But so far, and because we're a software company, we're able to do this ourselves, we've been investing in our understanding and use of tools internally, because there haven't been, major innovations that have truly helped physical space designers as it relates to human experience. But I do think that the use of AI tools will absolutely change the ratio of people that are working in information worker jobs and what they're doing. And if our research approach continues to be successful, we will be able to shift how we design spaces, because we will always be observing how those jobs change as AI changes those jobs. And so we'll be able to change that space to measure how that space is used differently as the ratios of people change because of AI. But still early days, definitely. Yep. In the physical space.
Yeah.
World.
Well, I think AI is a topic I need to have on my next podcast. So
for
maybe
sure.
I'll have you and another technologist come in.
There are many people smarter than me on this topic. But yeah, as it relates to digital, that's a different story. I mean, right. I think what you'd hear from anyone in digital it is becoming revolutionary. And we are on the digital side, where we're writing software, we're seeing incredible advances. So it's only a matter of time before those advances, which are currently applied to writing software, will make their way to the world of physical space. And we look forward to it.
Yeah,
For sure.
Exciting. Well, good. Keith, I really appreciate you coming in from Plano, Texas to Chicago. Not necessarily just for this, but taking the time out of your busy day.
I appreciate you hosting me here. And yeah, we do have a studio in Dallas and in Chicago and in San Francisco. So I'm in those cities a fair amount, but I live in Dallas and love coming here. Everyone tells me the weather is going to be horrible, but it's sunny and beautiful again. I must just be lucky or something, but it's a gorgeous day in Chicago, and I appreciate you having me.